The Nebraska Supreme Court is set to make a ruling on whether people with felony convictions can vote.
The ACLU also speaking out on this issue, saying a denial would disenfranchise an estimated 7,000 Nebraskans, as well as tens of thousands who already have their voting rights restored since another law was passed in 2005.
Oh, okay, so we're going to disenfranchise Nebraska. No big deal, right? Think again.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling there's something right.
How are they?
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in still sweltering Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon, on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, and Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, they could be staring down a hurricane in a day or two. Let's see, in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. As you can tell already, there is a lot going on. We've got a lot we're going to try to get to. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
As we go to air today, by the way, also, just moments ago, we've got breaking news out of the Supreme Court in my old home state of Missouri. Regarding the ballot measure seeking a restoration of the right to abortion this November in a state that has all but banned the procedure entirely in all but the most dire circumstances, the ability for that measure to even be on the ballot was struck down by a lower court in the state just days before the ballot printing deadline. But now, according to the news that is just now breaking, apparently that measure has been restored to the ballot in Missouri for this November's election.
That is good news. There's lots of shenanigans in lots of Republican-controlled states to stop voters from doing so.
I'll get to a bit more on that in a bit, plus our latest Green News report amid extreme heat, as I mentioned, and wildfires out here in California and elsewhere around the West. I think it's pretty warm up in Oregon as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it is.
I will get to all of that. But as we go to air, we are also just hours away from the likely one and only presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump in Philadelphia. We will have full roundtable coverage of that critical debate on our next broadcast with Desi. Digby and Driftglass joining us?
Yes, again? We're getting the band back together for fun and frolic.
There you go. That's our next broadcast. But for the moment, I've got a guest standing by that I want to get straight to regarding the right to vote this year in a state that could play a very key role in that contest. Now, last week on the program, I sort of broke down the bare minimum path that Kamala Harris would need to defeat Donald Trump in the Electoral College this year in a system that is decidedly weighted in favor of Republicans. But as I explained, if the Harris-Walz ticket can win the so-called blue wall states of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, and they won all of the traditional Democratic states, but none of the other swing states. Well, she would end up winning the Electoral College with 270 votes, the exact number needed to win the presidency. But that also assumes that she wins the 2nd District of Nebraska, which, along with Maine, is one of the only two states that actually divvy up their state's electoral votes based on House districts. Most of the states do winner-take-all systems, but not Nebraska. Nebraska's 2nd District includes Omaha. It tends to lean Democratic in presidential elections, which is just one of the reasons that some Republicans in the state have long been trying, certainly over the past year or so, to end the practice of splitting up electoral votes in the state by district, and they'd prefer to see the state go to a winner-take-all system since much of the rest of the state tends to vote Republican. Now, they have not yet been successful there, but that has not kept them from another way of trying to win that 2nd district this year, without which it is totally plausible that the Electoral College vote could actually end up tied at 269 votes apiece. Nebraska's Legislative Bill 53, or LB 53, was adopted almost 20 years ago in 2005. According to Alex Bernas at Bolts Magazine, in a recent story, the law, the almost 20-year-old law, finally ended a Nebraska policy that dated back to 1875 that imposed blanket lifetime felony disenfranchisement, a practice that, as of 2005, was unusually harsh even back then, and one which only persists today formally in a couple of former Confederate states. And hardly anywhere else in the world, by the way. About 59,000 Nebraskans with felony convictions were instantly granted the right to vote after the enactment of that 2005 law, which made people eligible to vote 2 years after they completed their full criminal sentences, including parole, probation, and any debt of restitution. The reform disproportionately benefited people of color at the time. Nebraska's black imprisonment rate is almost 10 times higher than that of white residents, an unusually high disparity that is about 50% above the U.S. average, reports Bernas. Latino and Native American people are also dramatically overrepresented in Nebraska jails and prisons. The ACLU of Nebraska reports that in addition to the 59,000 people whose voting rights were restored back in 2005, another 38,000 have gained their voting rights in the 19 years since that law was passed, thanks to that reform. But in part, because of the 2-year waiting period, there was confusion about whether former felons were actually able to register, which Bernas at Bolts explains was one of the reasons for a new bill that was adopted this year, LB 20, which, though it took years of sustained advocacy to become law, ultimately proved quite popular in Nebraska's legislature. It was introduced by a bipartisan group of lawmakers. It passed the state house by a vote of 38-6 back in April. And it's the state's Republican governor, Jim Pillen, though he declined to sign the bill, he also declined to veto it, and so it became law. But then, on July 17, just a month or so ago, this past summer, less than 48 hours before LB 20 was set to take effect, Nebraska's Republican Attorney General Mike Hilgers issued an advisory opinion stating that the new law was unconstitutional. But Hilgers did not stop there. He also declared unconstitutional the 2005 law that ended lifetime disenfranchisement of anyone convicted of any felony after that 2-year waiting period following the completion of their sentence. The 2-year waiting period that LB 20, passed overwhelmingly by the state legislature, was supposed to eliminate. In his opinion, Hilgers challenged the legislature's ability to restore people's voting rights and said those powers rested solely with the state's Board of Pardons. That is a 3-member body composed of Hilgers himself, Republican Secretary of State Bob Evnen, and the Republican Governor Jim Pillen. They concluded Hilgers have sole discretion over whether to restore someone's voting rights, not the legislature. But this gets even crazier. Right after Hilgers issued his opinion, Secretary of State Evnen, the state's top election official, emailed county-level elections offices ordering that, based on the AG's position, quote, "We will not be implementing LB 20 and will no longer register individuals convicted of felonies." Apparently, at all. Never mind that two-year waiting period. No convicted former felons would be allowed to register to vote. Would they even be allowed to vote if they were previously registered? All of this became unclear. All of this is being challenged, and this week is being heard by the Nebraska Supreme Court. Joining us now to hopefully shed some light on this, just over 50 days before what is arguably the most critical presidential election in the nation's history, where Nebraska could play a pivotal role, is Alex Burness, the staff reporter at the excellent Progressive Bolts magazine and a veteran journalist who focuses on voting rights, criminalization, and the justice system. Oh, Mr. Burness, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thank you for having me again. It's good to be here.
Now, I understand that this advisory opinion by the attorney generals is being challenged. The state Supreme Court is looking at it, will soon rule on this matter. But the chaos alone seems to be doing much of the work of what I see as a blatant attempt to disenfranchise eligible voters to vote. That's how I see it. Do I understand this correctly, that two individuals in Nebraska, both Republican in this case, but that doesn't really matter to me, frankly, just two individuals, the AG and the Secretary of State, have been able to essentially thwart the wishes of the state legislature and even the governor to not only block this bill ending the two-year waiting period, but essentially block 20 years of former felon re-enfranchisement and prevent thousands from being able to register and even perhaps vote?
Yeah, I think you understand it correctly. The move by these two officials may not stand. This is, you know, what they have commanded for now, mm-hmm. Really what the Secretary of State has commanded based on a non-binding opinion, as you mentioned, from the Attorney General. The Supreme Court, as soon as this Friday, or maybe next Friday, it'll be on a Friday is all we know, could issue a decision and could send things back to how they were on July 17th, and the engine could restart for registration for folks who are affected by this. But you zeroed in on the same thing that I focused on in my reporting on this, which is the chaos and confusion that has resulted. Yeah. People in Nebraska, tens of thousands of people in Nebraska, are suddenly left to wonder, do I have voting rights? If I do, when can I register? Am I likely to run afoul of any election laws? That last question is a big one that people are going to be asking themselves. I write about this topic all over the country. You and I have talked about it in other states as well, and it's remarkably consistent how often you hear from people who have past felony convictions and at some point or another have lost their voting rights or currently don't have voting rights, just how nervous they are to break any possible law, to step over any line, because as we've seen in some states recently, If they don't face actual arrest, there's fear that they could. So this has really cast quite a broad shadow over the state of Nebraska and the, you know, almost 100,000 people affected by this. And I don't expect that shadow to lift no matter what the Supreme Court does.
Yeah, that was the sense that I got, that no matter what decision ends up happening, you've got a whole bunch of people who are very nervous. It is unclear at this point, even, do you have a sense of what happens in the event, no matter how the Supreme Court rules here, but if someone tries to register in Nebraska, because they think they're former felons, they think they're able to vote now, Is it simply a matter of, oh, their registration will be blocked because they're a former felon, or are they actually committing a crime at that point by trying to even try to register?
I'm not sure the answer to that question, and I'm not a lawyer. Mm-hmm. I know that the Secretary of State has, pursuant to, you know, his authority, ordered local elections officials not to allow new registrations by people with past felonies. So I have not heard of anybody being arrested or charged or facing any kind of criminal issues related to trying to register and when they're not able. Mm-hmm. But I think it almost doesn't matter. Well, of course it matters if anybody's getting arrested, and mm-hmm. we'll report on that if and when it happens. But the big thing here is that even people who are much more tapped in than I am about voting rights in Nebraska, attorneys who work on this every day, constitutional law professors, elections experts who live in Nebraska and breathe this stuff every day, people who work in reentry, who do the very heavy lifting in that state mm-hmm. To actually help people get back as voters and get civically engaged, they are very confused right now about what the state of play is at the moment. And I think people are understandably erring on the side of, okay, let's deal with this one thing at a time. Right now, the Secretary of State has ordered these local elections officials not to register people with felonies. Let's wait and see what the Supreme Court says. As I mentioned earlier, though, it's going to be really hard to restart that engine. You had said, and everybody's, of course, aware, in less than 2 months, we've got a presidential election, not to mention everything else that's being voted on. And it's really hard to put this toothpaste back in the tube. It's a massive effort to simply inform people of what their rights are. Mm-hmm. In the story that I wrote on this the other day, I talked to a man, and I've heard this from people in other states in his similar situation, who said, I didn't even know I could vote. He's been out of prison mm-hmm. for years. He can register to vote, or at least he could have,
right,
as of a few weeks ago in Nebraska. He had no idea. And he said, he works in reentry. He says, I know hundreds of people in this position. Nobody ever talks about this. Nobody ever knows. So there were organizations ready to go on July 19th. It was going to be a big campaign. It was going to be a huge effort following this legislative bill
yeah.
to inform people, hey, you've got the right to vote. And restarting that after, you know, these headlines surely have trickled down to a lot of folks who are just going to be permanently scared away. And in that sense, if the goal of the AG and the SOS was to suppress turnout among the disproportionately city-dwelling, mm-hmm. disproportionately people of color who are in this affected population, if that was the goal, it was a very clever, if extremely cynical, move. Because no doubt there will be, I hesitate to put a number on it, but safely say in the thousands of people in Nebraska who sit this one out, even if the Supreme Court decides on Friday, never mind, you can vote.
Sure. Why not? Play it safe. I mean, we certainly saw what happened down in Florida when Ron DeSantis down there started rounding up former felons on television, on camera, who had no idea they were not allowed to register or vote because of these changing laws, because of these chaos. And by the way, you know, we see this a lot with laws like this, even with well-intentioned laws where they're, you know, removing the disenfranchisement rules, where they don't include anything in the laws about letting people know that they are now, you know, available, eligible to vote. And that's important, it seems to me, because you report at Bolts Magazine that even before the confusion about these bills, there were a lot of former felons in Nebraska who did not register because they were simply under the impression that they couldn't do it. Why is that? Is it a purposeful misrepresentation, as you see it, by Nebraska officials? Because this is, you know, going back now 20 years to the original re-enfranchisement law here. Why don't they know about this in Nebraska?
Yeah, you're hitting on something that's really important. I would say that felony disenfranchisement doesn't get enough attention as it is. And when it is talked about, I don't think it's always on the most responsible or informed terms. Mm-hmm. I think that a couple basic things for people to know before wading in on this topic is that, A, in the vast majority of cases, the laws governing these things date back to, or at least are partially based on, laws that go back as far as 100, 150 years to Reconstruction, mm-hmm. to the Jim Crow era, that are explicitly meant to keep, in many cases, Black people from voting, to set up barriers between would-be voters and the act of voting. That's one. The other thing is that, as you mentioned earlier, as we reported in the story, these kind of felony disenfranchisement laws that we're seeing now in Nebraska, that exist in Tennessee, that exist in Mississippi, Virginia, and other places, are incredibly unusual almost anywhere else in the world. So the U.S. is exceptionally harsh, and the state we're talking about today is at the moment exceptionally harsh within that exceptionally harsh bubble. So there is a real dearth, I would say, of good reporting out there about how this stuff works, how unusual the U.S. is on this front. Mm-hmm. But when you see these headlines, it'll be, you know, for better or worse, you know, 100,000 people get their voting rights back in Kentucky, or 100,000 people's voting rights are suddenly snatched back in Nebraska, whatever it is. Very often people have no idea, as you're mentioning. That is a really, really huge problem. I did a story last year in Kentucky mm-hmm. on a move by Andy Beshear, the governor there, mm-hmm. to re-enfranchise about 200,000 people,
yep.
which was an absolutely landmark move. Mm-hmm. I mean, just massive. And there were some headlines about it. In fact, there were many headlines. And what I found was, digging just a little bit beneath that, they didn't bother to tell anybody about this.
Right.
Nobody knew. So literally years later, door to door, text message by text message, booths at local festivals, stuff like that, phone banks, volunteers, in many cases, people who themselves have at one point lost the right to vote or still can't vote, are having to trickle this information out to Kentuckians. That's an example of a well-intended policy that has, you know, led to a ton of confusion because they just didn't say anything. So people in Kentucky don't know they have the right to vote in many cases. Mm-hmm. People in Nebraska, on the other side of it, just have no idea where they stand. I mentioned this one guy I talked to who has been out of prison for years, who said, oh, I just have assumed that they didn't have the right to vote. This stuff is also... In this environment where this doesn't get treated as majorly scandalous, mm-hmm. I mean, we can get to how kind of problematic and sad it is that our story was the one to sort of blow this open mm-hmm. nationally, because it's the kind of thing that in a just world and a just media landscape, you know, would have been front page news
sure.
for a ton of outlets many, many weeks ago. But I digress. The headlines that you do see come out of this about arrests in Florida, for example, mm-hmm. about what's gone on in Virginia in the last couple of years, about what's happening in Nebraska now, people in this affected population, those who are returning from prison or who got their rights back and maybe want to register, the news gets really nationalized and people are spooked by what they see in other places. Mm. We treat these as silos often. I've probably been guilty of it too. You know, Nebraska does this, Kentucky does this, Florida does that. Mm. But it's really all part of one kind of big picture that for the folks who are affected by these laws often just amounts to confusion and fear and an ultimate feeling of, I guess, being relegated to a sort of permanent underclass when they see headlines like people arrested in Florida or yeah. Glenn Youngkin ceases registration or Nebraska snatching back all these rights. It's easy to see how that can make somebody feel and how that would really scare somebody out of wanting to engage.
And, you know, you make a good point. It really is the advocacy groups, the advocates, a lot of times former felons, who are the ones publicizing this in the various states, publicizing the idea that rights have been restored. In Nebraska, it's a group called Voting Rights Restoration Coalition. Folks can go to getmyvoteback.org to find out if they can actually vote in Nebraska. But, I also want to note that though this does seem to be, Republicans in state after state trying to suppress the vote at this point, Nebraska has not traditionally been, an extraordinarily partisan state. In fact, the previous Secretary of State, John Gale, from 2000 to 2019, he's a Republican, but he's actually signed on in support of the lawsuit against what is going on right now under the current Secretary of State. He charges that what they are trying to do would lead to disorder in this year's general election. How much of this, I mentioned it during the intro here, how much of this do you suppose in Nebraska specifically has to do with the second congressional district and that one electoral vote that could end up deciding a presidential election this year?
I can't say for sure. I think one doesn't need to have their tinfoil hat on to connect some very basic dots here.
Uh-huh.
And so I think it's, entirely possible, plausible. Look, if you wanted to skew the electorate, even by a few thousand votes in what could be a very close second congressional district, that could, as you note, literally decide the presidency.
Yeah.
If you were looking for levers you could pull at this late hour, well, that's one of them.
Yeah.
In fact, it's a very good one. Like I said, no matter what happens from here on out, there are going to be people who don't vote. I have somebody quoted in my story who said to me, this is an important election. I've been excited to vote. I really want to have my voice heard. And I'm not going to vote no matter what the Supreme Court says, because I just don't want to touch it. So, as I said, clever, cynical, effective move by these officials. We'll see what happens. We'll see how wide the margin ends up being in the second district and how relevant these thousands or tens of thousands of potential voters or folks who sit out end up being. But, again, I don't think it's much of a leap at all to at least entertain the question of, is this just an attempt to throw the White House to Donald Trump, and the collateral damage being, folks in prison, folks formerly in prison who are very used to being collateral damage in so many other ways anyway. It's a familiar playbook.
Yeah, it is. And the fact that it's Nebraska, not Mississippi, not Virginia, not Florida, is one of the reasons why I mentioned it's not traditionally, one of the former southern states where you see this kind of partisanship. Unlike, for example, Mississippi, which you wrote about earlier in the summer, where there is similar confusion around felony disenfranchisement laws. You reported earlier this year, kind of similar mayhem playing out in Mississippi, where that state went to federal court, essentially, as I understand it, to uphold their Jim Crow era provision in state constitution for lifetime bans on former felons, with the federal court down there, U.S. District Court, I guess, determining that, actually that's an appellate court, determining that no, Mississippi has every right to prevent former felons from voting, that it is not a punishment, much less cruel and unusual punishment. Is that still where that case stands down in Mississippi? Are felons still disenfranchised down there where they are disproportionately black, of course?
Yeah, they still are. That was another, big moment from earlier this summer. The case being that a three-judge panel on the very conservative Fifth Circuit had overturned Mississippi's lifetime ban, which, to my point earlier, when we talk about these things, it's easy just to gloss over, Mississippi, they're, certainly tougher on crime than other states, lifetime ban. I mean, those are really unusual words. Lifetime ban.
Yes.
You cannot vote ever in your life if you live in Mississippi and have any felony on your record related to any of 23 categories of crime. I mean, you'd have to scour the entire globe just to, I believe you could literally count on one hand the number of countries that have policies similar to that.
Yeah.
So that's what it's been in Mississippi. This three-judge panel last year rules that this is cruel and unusual and overturns it, but nothing actually changes, because then the full Fifth Circuit decides we're going to take this up, and everybody knows what's going to happen once they make that move. The Fifth Circuit's exceptionally conservative, mm-hmm. and they have reversed what that panel did. So really, at the end of the day, nothing has actually changed in Mississippi. It was very harsh before. That harshness, was particularly effective at excluding black voters, black men, and it still is today.
And when we say it hasn't changed, let me be clear. It hasn't changed since 1890 and Mississippi's Reconstruction era constitution that put that that law into place in Mississippi, the law that is still the case today. Clearly, this was about black voter suppression back then. It still is now. Alex, before I let you go, I don't think this comes up in your story, but should we recognize the irony here that this is a fight over whether former felons can vote, in this case, this year, for a guy running for president who has been convicted of 34 felonies. So apparently you can run for president of the United States as a 34-time convicted felon, but I guess you can't vote for or against him if you wrote a bad check 20 years ago in some of these states.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's obviously and deeply ironic. As long as you bring that up, though, I'll just say there's a lot of messaging right now on the Democratic side of, you know, Harris is the prosecutor, Trump is the felon, and I don't defend any of Trump's actions that netted him those felonies, but I think that it's a slippery slope to get carried away with that prosecutor versus felon thing. I mean, mm-hmm. I understand our politics and why that's the framing, and I don't think it's unreasonable, but there are millions of people out there in this country with felonies, past felonies, who in many, many cases are trying their very best to move on from that. Mm-hmm. And that label that gets attached like a four-letter word to people, felon, and that can dog them for the rest of their days, literally, yep. in places like Mississippi today, in places like Nebraska. I mean, that's just in the voting rights context, not to mention the thousand other ways that having a past felony can affect you moving forward. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's ironic that our quote-unquote felon, former president and maybe next president, is on the ballot and will be able to vote for himself, while 100,000 or so Nebraskans sit here wondering, you know, do I have any rights? And
right.
It's just, again, I think a dangerous game to play to use the word felon as too much of a stand-in based on what people think of Trump specifically, because yeah. in Nebraska and Mississippi and Kentucky and everywhere else, there's a lot of people who would like to vote, who would like to exercise their rights, who would yep. like to contribute positively to society, and they're locked out over and over and over.
Yeah, and I appreciate you making that point. I think it's a very good one because, by the way, if it was up to me, I would allow current felons to vote as they do still in some places around the world and even here in the U.S. I believe Vermont is one of the states that allows people in jail to vote. I think we all ought to be able to vote, and I think people who are imprisoned have as much right as anybody else, and arguably more than anyone else, since they are so closely affected by the laws that are passed by the people they vote for. But it's very difficult, when you got a party who is pretending to be the party of law and order, who are then running a guy who has been charged, convicted of 34 felonies, charged with a whole bunch of other ones, and they won't even let former felons, people who have served their time, to vote for or against that guy. It does need to be called out, I think, no matter what. But your point is also a very good one, Alex. Alex Burness is the staff reporter at the excellent Progressive Bolts magazine. You can find them at boltsmag.org. You can find them on the Twitters at boltsmag, and you can find Alex on the site still known as Twitter at Alex_Burness. Really appreciate your work here, Alex, and look forward to speaking to you soon.
Of course. Thank you for having me on.
You bet. Okay, let's take a quick break. We've got a lot more to get to here, including the breaking news from the top of the show about the abortion measure in Missouri. I've got some listener mail I want to get to, and Desi Doyen's Green News Report.
Yay.
All of that straight ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to do it. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate to make an automated monthly pledge of any amount you like, or even just a one-time-only contribution to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. The fight for voting rights, civil rights, and to save our planet continues. Please help us continue that fight independently over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate right now. Go ahead, do it right now. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We are not going straight to Green News Report here, but we are indeed melting with you, at least out here on the West Coast.
Yes.
As I mentioned at the top of the show, we had some breaking news that I want to get some more details on now that I've had a moment to look at it. An amendment to restore abortion rights in Missouri will be on the ballot this November, according to the state's Supreme Court. The proposal to enshrine abortion rights in the state's constitution is expected to widely undo the state's 2022 near total abortion ban if it is passed by voters in November. Judges on the state's high court ruled just hours before the Tuesday deadline for changes to be made to the November ballot before it heads to the printers, etc. Mary Catherine Martin, the lawyer for a group of GOP lawmakers and abortion opponents suing to remove the amendment, told the Supreme Court judges during Tuesday's arguments that the initiative petition to put this measure on the ballot, quote, misled voters by not listing all of the laws restricting abortion that would effectively be repealed by this ballot measure. A lower court judge had agreed with that argument previously, bringing us to Tuesday's argument at the state Supreme Court in Missouri. But the abortion rights campaign lawyer, Chuck Hatfield, described the lawsuit as a quote, an attempt to derail democracy. Republican Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft, yes, the son of former U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft under the George W. Bush administration, and that family has been all over Missouri politics for years and years and years. He opposes abortion. He decertified this measure on Monday. He removed it from the ballot following a county circuit judge's ruling last Friday. But that ruling has now been overruled by the Missouri Supreme Court. The measure to restore abortion rights will appear on this year's ballot in the Show Me State after all. This, of course, part of a national push for voters to weigh in on abortion following the U.S. Supreme Court's corrupt overturning of Roe v. Wade back in 2022, overturning what had been a constitutional right for some 50 years. Missouri banned almost all abortions immediately thereafter in response in the state. Eight other states will also consider constitutional amendments enshrining abortion rights this November, including Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Maryland, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, and South Dakota. Most of the measures would guarantee a right to abortion until fetal viability and allow it later for the health of the pregnant woman, which is what the Missouri proposal would do in this case. New York has also a ballot measure that proponents say would protect abortion rights. There's some dispute about exactly what it would or wouldn't do. Democrats, of course, are hopeful that these measures will get folks out to the polls in some of those states I mentioned, very critical elections going on. So Democrats hope this will get some folks out who might not otherwise come out or who might otherwise show up for the abortion measures and then end up voting for Democrats while they're there, potentially impacting results for the presidency in several swing states, control of Congress, and the outcomes, of course, of many closely contested state offices. Similar legal fights have sprung up across the country over whether to allow voters to decide these questions and over the exact wording that would be used on the ballots and the explanatory material, etc. Republicans are particularly sensitive about all of this because voters in all seven states that have already had these type of questions on their ballots since Roe was overturned have all sided with abortion rights supporters. In all seven states, that includes deep red ones like Kansas and Kentucky. And of course, Democrats in Missouri are hopeful that it'll help their chances this November, perhaps even in my old home state.
Yeah, so clearly voters wish to restore their own rights, and clearly Republicans are working very hard to stop them and invent new and interesting ways to try to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Well, I should say clearly in the seven states that have held these elections so far,
yeah.
We don't know about these other states.
That's
we'll
true.
See.
We don't know yet.
Missouri, which has a complete and total ban by and large on abortion, if in fact they are ready to restore those rights there. Should be interesting.
Well, clearly Republicans in those states believe that they are very likely to pass. Otherwise, they wouldn't be throwing up
so hard.
Any and all barriers to stop voters from restoring their own rights.
You got that right. All right, I want to get to quickly a few letters, both via email to bradcast@bradblog.com and one, if you can believe it, actual snail mail letter that was sent to me at KPFK, our flagship station here in L.A., a couple of weeks ago, apparently. But I only just got it yesterday from the station. See how snail mail works? Anyway, first, email from Cynthia L. after yesterday's show discussing Liz and even Dick Cheney's endorsement of Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris, because apparently in the Trump era, even pigs fly now. Cynthia writes, I will be joining Dick and Liz and voting for Kamala too. And by the way, she adds, thank you, Joe Biden. With the tax credits President Biden created for clean, green energy, I was able to expand my solar system to 20 panels and get a battery backup and replace a bunch of old inefficient windows with new efficient ones and get a new heat pump system to replace my old dead air condition and my old dead gas furnace.
Nice.
All of that, she notes, was an expensive lift for me, and those tax credits sure helped.
Glad to hear that. There are more and more homeowner upgrade incentives that are being rolled out from the Inflation Reduction Act in every state. Every state is taking it at a different pace, but do pay attention to your own state and see what's available both for homeowners and for renters.
Sounds like Cynthia is making out pretty well on that. She adds,
yes.
As a result, I've not had to send a check to PG&E, that's the power
Pacific
utility
gas and
company
electric,
out
yeah.
here, right? I had to send a check to PG&E for payment due since March of this year. She says from April on, every statement has said no payment due.
Nice.
Thanks to all that solar and the battery backup, etc. She says, I love it, especially since I would not be able to afford to run an AC on these super hot days. Well, at least she's got one. She adds, so thank you, Joe Biden, from Cynthia. And via snail mail, as noted, this was apparently sent a few weeks ago, so I don't remember the specific reference that the listener Ed here is referring to. I'm sure it's something Desi said, but with wildfires raging again today across the state, which we'll get to in our Green News report in a second, and a bunch of evacuations in mountainous areas and so forth. This note, even though I'm late in getting it, is still quite germane, it seems to me, from Ed. Hi, Brad, he writes. You and Desi mentioned 300,000 Americans moving to disaster-prone areas, suggesting that they didn't get the message. The message to not move to disaster-prone areas, I guess in this case, like these mountainous wooded areas. He says we moved to Tennant, California, deep in the forest in Siskiyou County 18 years ago. Why? Because following job loss, it was the only place we could afford. Reportedly, half of Americans live on $35,000 or less per year. Rent in Tennant was $400 to $450 per month. Now, I don't remember the exact reference here. I'm sure it was when we were covering some of the fires in some of the wooded areas, though. What I remember actually is talking about folks moving to disaster-prone areas, for example, on the coast.
Yes, it was, if I remember correctly.
The houses are much more expensive, the property is more expensive on the coast,
yes.
And that these people were doing this anyway, knowing floods and hurricanes, et cetera.
And now that you mention it, I believe there was a Washington Post article that found that 300,000 Americans, that data mostly concerned people moving to Florida and the Gulf Coast, where, as you say, the
coastal
homes are
areas.
Much more expensive,
yeah.
And they expect or are likely to expect to be bailed out.
Nonetheless, making the point here, listener Ed says that he moved to one of these areas which could be prone to forest fires because that's what they could afford.
Right.
He goes on to note that the Antelope wildfire devastated Tennant on August 5th in 2021. Mm. And he adds, we became homeless and still are. Moving to fire-prone areas is a necessity for the poorest of the poor. It isn't that we are unaware of the risk. It is absolute desperation and extreme poverty that drives people such as we. His wife and I, he says, have been grateful listeners for many years. Send our thanks and best wishes to you and Desi from listener Ed. So thank you for that note, Ed. Greatly appreciated. And I certainly understand. Again, could have been me in one of my snarky comments in the Green News Report talking about moving into wooded areas, though my reference is more to the rich people moving to the coast, knowing that they're houses are going to be flooded or wiped out by hurricanes that are getting worse and worse as our climate crisis gets worse.
Yeah,
and worse.
And absolutely. Affordability is a huge factor, especially in Western states where, you know, we're in the middle of an acute housing crisis,
yeah,
in California, and it's growing across the country, too. So, you know, not just the housing crisis, but also the growing home insurance crisis where people who have homes and have lived there for decades are suddenly finding, both in Florida, in California, and in Texas, mm-hmm, that their insurance company is dropping and will not be renewing their home insurance. And that's just a sad and dangerous and really complex issue that has been decades in its development. And it's going to take a very huge effort and really smart people electing really smart politicians to address it. So I want to just thank you, Ed, for giving us that chance to tell your story, because this is so important in this election to address these issues.
I would say it's going to take a government effort to,
yes,
to fix it, to ensure some of these folks in these disaster prone areas. Kamala Harris has already come out and said she's got a plan to build some, 3 million new houses,
yeah,
to increase the housing stock. I don't know that Donald Trump has such a plan. If he does, it has something to do with the late, great Hannibal Lecter or something. Maybe Hannibal Lecter will build the houses. But it seems at least that Kamala Harris has such a plan. I will note that on the back of the envelope, despite all that Ed has been through that he writes about, and thank you again for sending that note, Ed, he writes on the back of the envelope, peace, faith, love, joy, and hope.
Nice.
Thanks, Ed. Much appreciated. Let's get to it. Speaking of disasters, our latest Green News report.
It's not surprising that we see this heat wave, that we see these temperature extremes, and we are bound to see more.
The planet just endured the hottest summer ever recorded again. Extreme heat and fires broil the West as Storm Francine threatens the U.S. Gulf Coast. Plus,
we're out of water.
State Agriculture Commissioner warns parts of Texas have run dry.
All of those warnings and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We have much bigger problems out here. It was 104 today here. It was 118 in the valley. Oh, God. I was sweating like J.D. Vance in a donut shop.
Wow. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, yes, it's hot out here, and it's still hot out here. Hopefully, over the next 24 hours or so, it will finally cool down out here in Southern California. Until then, I'll be over in the corner melting into a puddle.
Well, first, the planet just lived through the hottest summer on record for the second straight year. Summer 2024, that's June, July, and August, surpassed 2023 as the hottest summer globally, according to Europe's climate service, Copernicus. Climate scientists say the string of record global temperatures underscores the urgency of reducing greenhouse gas emissions to prevent future summers from becoming even hotter. The heat fueled widespread impacts across all continents, from droughts, deadly heat waves, wildfires, and of course, storms and floods, like in Vietnam, where the strongest typhoon in at least a decade struck on Saturday. More than 60 people are confirmed dead there. Here in the U.S., as we go to air, the record hot Gulf of Mexico is fueling the rapid intensification of Tropical Storm Francine, forecast to hit the Gulf Coast as a hurricane, bringing rain and flooding to areas still recovering from Hurricane Beryl.
And again, it was one of these hurricanes, a tropical storm for now, that sort of developed, spun up out of nowhere over 24 hours.
Yep, and now a new Columbia University study confirms that thanks to man-made climate change driven by the burning of fossil fuels, hurricanes today are now twice as likely to jump to a Category 3, 4, or 5 than storms did 40 or 50 years ago because of hotter oceans. The researchers project that we will see even more storms leveling up into Category 3 or higher in coming decades. Here's meteorologist Dr. Jeff Berardelli.
That matters because as your winds increase in hurricanes, the damage potential does not go up linearly. It goes up exponentially.
Unfortunately, Francine's rains won't help South or West Texas. The state's agriculture commissioner, Sid Miller, on Monday warned that farms are closing in parts of West Texas and the Rio Grande Valley because they are out of water. The shortfall is due to a complex combination of water disputes with Mexico, overpumping of groundwater by big agricultural growers, and the fracking industry, which uses up millions of gallons of fresh water for every well.
Well, what do you want? Water or energy? Apparently, we got to choose between them both.
And overall, climate change is also drying out the West. In an interview with local news, Miller called on state leaders to do more.
We got to stop wasting water. We have the federal government has several programs to replace infrastructure. We're just not tapping into those like we should be.
Oh, like that infrastructure bill passed almost entirely by Democrats? Okay.
A dangerously intense heat wave is broiling the western U.S., generating wildfires. More than 2 million acres are currently burning across the West. The biggest are in California, Nevada, and Idaho. In San Bernardino, California, east of Los Angeles, evacuations are underway from the Line Fire, which quadrupled in size over the weekend. The intense heat in Southern California caused a natural gas plant to trip offline, but the state's grid is holding up after rapidly expanding its resources of utility-scale solar plants and batteries over just the last year.
Renewable energy, saves the day again.
Finally, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump late last week vowed to claw back all unspent funding from President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act if he wins the November election. So the Biden administration is racing to push out billions in clean energy and infrastructure funding. Biden announced another tranche of more than $7 billion for rural communities across the country for grid repairs and clean energy projects. It's the biggest investment in rural electricity since the New Deal, but it is an open question as to whether or not rural Americans will ever hear about it.
Well, we're trying to let them know. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. I thought summer was supposed to be over. We've had Labor Day. How is it that we're still in the middle of a cruel summer, Desi Doyen?
Well, hello to climate change, I guess.
Yeah, and hello to Hurricane Francine.
Yes.
That's about to happen.
Yes, and of course, folks in Louisiana need to be sure that they are getting ready. It looks like New Orleans might really get in the barrel this
really?
Time. So, you know, we'll see. Everybody get ready as soon as you can. But also just want to warn folks that after landfall, Francine is predicted by the National Weather Service to go up the Midwest in the Mississippi River. So everybody that is on the Mississippi River, be ready for some rain coming your way. St. Louis, Chicago, it's a rainmaker, so just get ready.
Got that, Mom? By the way, we could use it out here, out west. We could use some of that rain.
But we're not going to get it.
We're not going to get it. All right. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks again to my guest today, Alex Burness of Bolts Mag, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is always made available for free. Thanks to those of you who hit one of those donate buttons when you stop by or who go to bradblog.com/donate to sign up, if you don't mind, for a subscription, a monthly subscription of any amount you can afford. It would be greatly appreciated and help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. All right, tomorrow we are back with our roundtable special coverage of the probably one and only presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump with our special guests, Digby and Driftglass. Right?
Yes.
Okay. That's tomorrow on the Bradcast. Until then, we'll see you at all of the above, and then we'll see you here. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.